that the Orange County Peace Coalition is able to host this event featuring the NAFTA. This event, I think, is really an important one for the Orange County Peace Coalition as we approach the core of the presidential season. Now, the Orange County Peace Coalition is a nonpartisan entity, and so it might seem strange at first that we would be hosting something focusing upon party conventions. But what we're really focusing on is the right to assemble. And I don't think one needs to look far to really read headlines that there are powerful forces working very hard to take the grass out of grassroots. And as a grassroots organization, it's really important that we find out what our rights are, what limits we have, and what we could do to make sure that we always have the right to assemble, the right to speak, and the right to challenge, because that isn't a right that anyone could give to us. It's only a right that could be taken away from us. The National Lawyers Guild, I'm sure we are all familiar with, so I will keep my comments brief. I will simply point out that they have certainly been working hard since the events of September the 11th. Immediately following, they issued a State of the Union post-September 11th. They began posting things that people should know if the FBI comes knocking on one's door. And they've really been at the forefront of fighting the culture of fear. So with that, I'm happy to introduce two speakers tonight. We have Robert Myers here from the National Lawyers Guild. He's the Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild Los Angeles chapter, and he is a coordinator of its Legal Observers Program. He is a native of Orange County, is that correct?
I grew up here, yes.
Grew up in Orange County, so it's nice to have Orange County represented by a group like the National Lawyers Guild. He grew up here, he says, when there were more orange trees than people. He graduated from Cal State Fullerton, something I know about, and Loyola Law School, and his law practice focuses on civil rights. And we also have Carol Sobel. She is the regional vice president of the National Lawyers Guild and the president of the Los Angeles chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. She's also been an attorney with the ACLU for 20 some years or so. I believe Mr. Myers will be our first presenter, but let's give a nice welcome to both presenters.
Good evening. Carol and I will be jumping back and forth covering different topics tonight. It's a pleasure to be here in Orange County, where I first started residing in 1954, so that was a long time ago when there were lots of orange trees here. It is a pleasure to be at a facility of the Sisters of St. Joseph, because the first time I was arrested in 1988, I had traveled to the Nevada nuclear weapons test site, and I had not decided whether or not to get arrested for my first time. I was Santa Monica City Attorney at the time, and it was a big decision for me as a public official to get arrested. And I saw three sisters from the Sisters of St. Joseph who I knew who had were very active in serving the homeless. They founded the St. Joseph Center in Venice, and they were getting arrested for the first time, and so I decided if these sisters could get arrested for the first time, so could I, and so we crossed the line together and were arrested. So it's a pleasure to be in this facility. We're going to cover the issue of the criminalization of dissent, the suppression of free speech that has been going on in this country for a number of years. We're going to start by showing some footage from the Seattle WTO protest in the end of 1999. The Seattle WTO protest were a marked change for law enforcement in this country. Since those protests, law enforcement agencies across California and across the country have acquired a vast array of what is known as less lethal weapons. And every several months, new less lethal weapons are coming on the market. I mean, there are people developing now for the military weapons that will basically stun and immobilize an entire crowd simply through some sort of electro field that will be discharged at people. But Seattle was the first time they used a wide variety of these weapons, less lethal munitions in terms of, you know, stinger rounds, hard rubber bullets that hit people, wood things shot out of guns, pepper spray, tear gas, etc. And every law enforcement agency says we need them too. And the Los Angeles Police Department started acquiring vast amounts of this weaponry in preparation for the Democratic National Convention that took place about a year later in Los Angeles. And we at the National Lawyers Guild had to prepare for the use of less lethal weapons in Los Angeles and how the police would respond. And so we developed a very comprehensive litigation strategy in Los Angeles to try to deal with what we knew was going to be the coming repression of dissent. The police did not want people close to the Staples Center where the Democratic National Convention was being held. They did not want people marching through the streets of downtown Los Angeles. They did not want people in Pershing Square Park in downtown Los Angeles. And as a result, we had to sue, and a number of lawsuits were brought to challenge the practices of the city of Los Angeles. We brought a very successful lawsuit that struck down the city's parade permit ordinance, the city's park permit scheme, and struck down the secure zone that they wanted to establish around the Staples Center. So we were successful in getting demonstrators close to the site of the Democratic National Convention. We also were successful in getting an injunction barring the police from raiding the Convergence Center, which was the protest headquarters. In Philadelphia at the Republican National Convention in 2000, the police raided the protest headquarters and destroyed puppets that were going to be used for expressive purposes. Simply went in, seized First Amendment items, and then destroyed them. And we were able to get an injunction barring the police from doing that here in Los Angeles. Although we were successful in getting the right to protest, the police nevertheless wanted to suppress all speech that was permitted by the courts. So therefore, it deployed massive numbers of police, heavily armed, that blocked people from entering and leaving marches, wrongfully arrested people, and then on the first day of the convention, the police declared an unlawful assembly because of a handful of disruptive conduct by a few people and started shooting people. And hundreds of people were hit with rubber bullets as a result of basically a police-caused riot. And because of the work of the National Lawyers Guild, we had hundreds of legal observers, and so although the city police department was praised by the city council for how it handled things, the city has now paid millions and millions of dollars in damages to people who were shot with rubber bullets. Many lawsuits have been resolved. There's one lawsuit left, which Carol and I are involved in, to try to change the policies of the city of Los Angeles, and we hope to bring that to a successful conclusion. But many of the people who were hit, there was a class action lawsuit that recently settled for over $1 million. People who were wrongfully searched had a big settlement, and there were lots of individual lawsuits that were settled as a result of all the work that the Lawyers Guild and others did collecting evidence in Los Angeles. And so Los Angeles, from a legal standpoint, was a success story in terms of winning in the court, but we also had a situation where the Los Angeles Police Department was quite brutal in how it dealt with demonstrators. And the Los Angeles Police Department still deploys less lethal weapons. In fact, just Friday I was at a demonstration, and I'll close this portion by just playing a statement from a Los Angeles police officer. And this is at a demonstration that had been prearranged. A bunch of workers at hotels who worked out with the police to use a public street. And the Los Angeles Police Department had numerous officers with less lethal weapons, and then they made this broadcast.
I hereby declare this to be an unlawful assembly, and in the name of the people of the state of California, command all those assembled in the intersection of 5th and Figueroa to immediately disperse, which means to break up this assembly. If you do not do so, you may be arrested or subject to other police action. Other police action may include the use of less lethal munition, which could cause significant risk of serious injury to those who remain.
So the Los Angeles Police Department is threatening a group of citizens with the use of less lethal weapons, which can cause serious bodily injury, and this was just a week ago. And so we still have a lot of work to do, and this is going on across the country, and Carol's going to give an update about the litigation in Miami, what's going on in New York, and then we'll go into some of the practical issues for those who are going to be going to New York about what you need to know. Carol?
So let me talk a little bit about what's going on around the country. And Bob talked about the WTO, and I think the WTO is you know, it's where you have to start in these discussions, because in addition to being sort of the watershed for how police responded to demonstrators, it is the point at which an urban myth began to grow. And this urban myth has been, this urban legend has been promoted by police departments around the country. And essentially, it involves a couple of fundamental elements. First, the anarchists are coming. It always begins with the anarchists are coming. And, you know, although most of you in this room look like very respectable people, in the eyes of much of law enforcement, you'd just be anarchists in various disguises. So the anarchists are coming is where it starts from. And because anarchists have no respect for the law or for people or for property, they do such things, the police tell each other, as throw bottles of urine at the police, throw rotten eggs at the police, throw chemicals at the police. I would dare you to find one reported incident in the last 5 years in this country where that has occurred. It has not. It did not occur at the Democratic National Convention. I'm unaware of any place where it has occurred. It is true that sometimes after the police open up fire on people or strike people, they will throw a water bottle, a plastic water bottle. I've seen that a couple of times. I've not seen mass occasions of that. But always in provocation by the police first, but never this incident where things that the police tell their officers to create that adverse tension, that real hostility towards the demonstrators, none of that ever comes true. I'm just unaware of any reports. And that's really important, though, because this urban legend that the police departments have built around the demonstrations after the WTO have really resulted in the police believing they have a license to go in and do preemptive actions to shut down demonstrations, and has created a real hostility where there does not need to be one between the demonstrators and the police, even before anybody goes out to a demonstration site, permitted, not permitted. We've seen a number of different events across the country with this occurred. Bob talked about the DNC here in Los Angeles at the Republican National Convention in 2000. Chief Timoney, who was then in Philadelphia, used a number of techniques that had not been used beforehand. And he did a number of things. Bob talked about him going into the Convergence Center where the demonstrators had organized and destroying the puppets beforehand, those large puppets people use. But he did more than that. He did preemptive arrests on the street. He went into the Convergence Center and arrested people. But the first night, as people walked down the street in a lawful protest, the Republican National Convention, 600 people approximately, I believe that's what it was in Philadelphia, were arrested. I may be confusing some of these demonstration numbers, but he did preemptive arrests. He arrested people who he believed were organizers, and he identified them because they were on the street with a cell phone. So being on the street with a cell phone got you arrested. And one guy from an environmental group, his name I forget at the moment, had a $1 million bond that he had to post, $1 million bond. That I know I am correct on. Ultimately, of course, all the charges were dropped. There was no offense. There was John Sellers of the Ruckus Society. Okay, but they were watching him, and they knew who he was, and he was on a cell phone, so clearly he must be up to no good. So he was picked up, held on a $1 million bond, and eventually there were no charges, right? So we go from $1 million bond, and we had the same thing here in Los Angeles, enhanced felony bonds for allegations of something that at best would be a misdemeanor. But in order to keep people in jail longer, in order to prevent them from getting out, just escalate the charges and escalate the bond. So this has become sort of grown, it has a life of its own. It's grown both in size, it's grown in force. And we come to the Miami model, what the law enforcement identified as the model of homeland security. And some of you may be aware there were protests in Miami last November to coincide with the meetings of the Free Trade Area of the Americas ministers, the FTA meetings. And the demonstrations were a combination of anti-globalization activists, retired Americans who are very unhappy with the globalization process and what that has meant to their pensions, to their benefits, in their retirement packages, with the destruction of their jobs, the companies they worked for, and the unions, the AFL-CIO. So the AFL-CIO got a huge permit, thought, of course, you know, as labor often does, that they're the good guys, so they could negotiate with the police and there would be no problem. Well, 40 agencies, 40 law enforcement agencies worked together to come up with the Miami model. Everybody from Homeland Security, which coordinated a lot of it, to the FBI, to the INS. I didn't know until I read the after action report from the City of Miami Police Department that that INS has a SWAT team as well. Because the INS SWAT team was in Miami, the FBI SWAT team was in Miami. This was all under the direction of Chief Timoney. Yes, Chief Timoney, who appears now to have a career moving from major city to major city to handle major demonstrations by attacking the demonstrators. So he was the chief at the RNC in 2000, and then he moved to Miami after not being hired by LA, and he was the chief for the FTAA, and he was supposedly, although after the Miami fiasco, the DNC tried to argue in public that they had never really finalized a contract with Timoney, but he was supposed to be the head of security for the DNC in Boston. But Miami was such a disaster that by then his charm has dissipated. Miami funded the less lethal munitions and the entire military operation that stifled dissent there with $8 million that came from the federal government. And it was part of an appropriation that you may recognize. It was part of this small $87 million appropriation that was voted up or down. It was your loyalty, your patriotism. Either you were for our troops in Iraq or you were not for our troops in Iraq. And by the way, either you're for shooting our children in Miami or you're not for shooting our children in Miami. The $8 million was part of the Iraq package. Okay, so it was not $87 million to our troops. It was actually only $79 million because the other $8 million went to Miami to shoot the demonstrators. Billions, right. But based on billions. Yeah. Billions, I'm sorry. But it was $8 million less because that went to Miami to shoot people, to shoot the demonstrators. The Miami model was, they were so brass about this, and so totally brash, that what they said in their after-action report was, their goal, their entire plan, was to prevent any possible violence from occurring by preventing demonstrations in the first place, to limit protests. In essence, we think there might be violence, but just in case, what we're going to do is we're going to wipe out the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment for these 4 days in Miami. It was actually a little bit longer. And that they did, arresting nearly 300 people. There was unprecedented police presence in the streets of Miami. As people walked down the sidewalk, they were stopped, questioned, arrested for nothing whatsoever. People standing on a sidewalk were stopped. Miami police would just come up to them and say, you don't look like you're from Miami. Well, you can tell, you know, one of our clients is from Colorado. People from Colorado, frankly, don't look like people from Miami for the most part. They're just not there in those Miami print shirts. They just don't have that beach look. They look out of place. So they were easy to identify. And we had clients there, and I say we because the National Lawyers Guild National Mass Defense Committee is representing most of the people who were arrested or shot there. Miami was really the first time where they came out with the absolutely unqualified statement that they intended to prevent people from demonstrating in order to prevent any potential problems down the line. We had people arrested. Our lead plaintiff in the case is a 71-year-old retired Korean War veteran, retired airline pilot and Korean War veteran, who was arrested as he was trying to find his bus to get back to Fort Myers. He had come down for the day to participate in the AFL-CIO demonstration. He was not a threat to anyone. He was simply walking along on the railroad tracks trying to find his bus again because the police would not let the buses come in when he was assaulted by 50 to 60 officers in riot gear, no identification on them. It was very difficult to determine who was doing what in Miami because you had 40 agencies and most of them had no identification visible. And that was intentional, so that you wouldn't know who was beating you up. You wouldn't know who was shooting you. And they pepper sprayed people, shot people at close range with less lethals, wound up embedding them in people's heads. One of our clients was shot in the head, and as she was bleeding and trying to crawl away, she'd been praying beforehand. She's just sitting there praying that they would stop shooting everyone. There was no one around her. And an officer shot her in the head with less lethal, and as she tried to crawl away, kicked her. So, you know, it's not simply, it's this level of violence and this level of cruelty as if the people out in the streets were the enemy, which has always been the situation. But there's a new license, I think, to go after people that I don't recall seeing since the Vietnam War era for the most part. I just want to talk a little bit more about what came out of that. Right after Miami, we started noticing that we started getting calls from people who had been in Miami and who had been arrested or stopped by the police, that they were being stopped and visited elsewhere in the country. And in Miami, when people got arrested, one of the things that happened is they got interviewed by federal agents who wanted to know what are the demonstrations that they'd been involved in, what plans did they know about for the RNC and the DNC coming up. It was really an interrogation opportunity, an information collecting opportunity. And we know from the videos, Bob shows you this video, but they all have a video that they send around and they put together. We believe it's being done out of Washington, D.C., because, and by the federal government, because one of the people in the video is a legal observer for my colleague and co-counsel in D.C., and he was featured prominently in the video being shown in Miami prior to the FTA by the police to warn business people, which is another thing they do, is they take these videos around, piece them together from different things, the Eugene Anarchist Convention where the police shot all the anarchists about 7-8 years ago now, that becomes as if it happened yesterday and it was their fault. And they piece all these little things together. Genoa, where we know that the police were the agents provocateurs, where we know that the police killed people without reason, went in and beat people while they were sleeping at the Convergence Center. They even admitted now. But it's being shown as if it were gospel and as if it were the demonstrators doing all this to hype the business community against people who come in to exercise their rights. This happened as well at the G8 in Boston, in Georgia, where there were 5 police officers for every demonstrator. Actually, ultimately, I think there were almost 100 police officers, about 75 police officers for every demonstrator, and 1 in 5 demonstrators was an undercover officer. So it was just extraordinary. But all of this is going on with this collection of this information nationally and internationally. The information isn't necessarily good. I should tell you that the legal observer who was featured prominently in the propaganda that the law enforcement put out in Miami before the FTA was during the course of the FTA demonstrations. And again, he's a law student from D.C. During the course of the FTA demonstrations, when he pointed out an undercover cop and told people to watch out because the guy that they thought was a demonstrator was an undercover cop, he was snatched by 2 guys in black hoods who were undercover cops. And when he got out of this van they had him in, he was arrested then for, you know, assaulting an officer, et cetera. But he was eventually charged with identifying an undercover officer, which is not a crime. There are lots of good cases. It's not a crime to do that. But he was, when he got out of that van, he didn't look as good as when he went in. He needed hospital treatment. And that happened over and over again in Miami. That was the other stunning thing about Miami. And when Bob talked about things like the new laser technology and the new tasers and that they're going to use, in Miami, for the first time, they used full body shield tasers on people. They just picked these kids out of people waiting to go into the AFL-CIO march, picked people out the line, threw them onto the ground, and applied this electronic shield on top of them that shocked their entire body. And as luck would have it, for the officers, the people that they did this to hadn't even been in the city of Miami at the time. They thought they thought they were somebody who had engaged in a fracas with the police in the morning. Well, our clients hadn't even been in the city. They had all come down on buses from, they were paid for by the unions from Tallahassee and other places in Miami, but that didn't seem to bother the police. And the level of force was just extraordinary. So people were visited, I'll just wrap this up, but people were visited, were questioned in Miami, and then people started to be visited. One of our client's brothers came out of class one day at school in upstate New York and found his van surrounded by six different law enforcement officers with guns pulled when he came out of class. And he had never, they thought he was his brother who had been arrested in Miami. Being arrested during a protest is not a capital offense. Yet. And yet, you know, they treated him as if they had just gotten Osama bin Laden. They just found the cave, you know, and they had Osama bin Laden and they were acting. And I'm not suggesting that that is a good thing. I'm just saying that's how the American soldiers act when they find someone that they've been searching for a while like that. So finally, I want to just wrap this up with the FBI interviews that are going on. You probably have heard the story on the news about people being questioned about what they know. And the government is arguing, of course, that this is a legitimate law enforcement technique. But what we're seeing happen is they're going around the country to people who've been at recent demonstrations. One of our clients who's been extremely public was, he was the person arrested for standing on the sidewalk in Miami 3 days before the FTA protest. He's he doesn't look like, he's from Colorado, Fort Collins, Colorado. He's a programmer for a large computer company that shall remain unnamed. And he just doesn't look like a beach guy from Miami. And so he got arrested for being on the street corner and not looking like he was from Miami. He was also arrested in an unpermitted parade in D.C. And he was visited recently by the FBI and has so far declined to talk to them. But the technique that they're using is if you decline to talk to us, we're just asking you questions, we just want to know, do you know anybody? And then they ask the question that is the key question. If you knew anything, would you tell us? And if your answer to that question is no, I wouldn't tell you anyway, you will find that you will shortly receive an invitation to appear in front of a grand jury. And people are being subpoenaed. So it is this intimidation tactic that is going on. Now, the most recent stories is that this was just a rogue Red Squad working out of Chicago, but I don't think anyone believes that. This rogue illegal Red Squad was traveling the entire country with no one knowing about it, seeking to obtain information about potential violence at the upcoming demonstrations. It's just not the way you would do it anyway. At least I don't think it would be, but so that's just sort of a basic update of where we are. There is affirmative litigation in Miami against the police department that we've already filed for the damages. There will be a lot more that is filed. So far to date, I believe not one person was convicted of the 230 plus that they arrested and charged. 280 were arrested, 230 were charged, and no one has been convicted except was one homeless guy who sort of got picked up during the course of the demonstration for drinking in public. That's the only conviction at this point. People who have gone to trial have received directed verdicts of acquittal from the judges. Once they see the information, see what the police did in Miami, they see how they shut down demonstrations. And so it's been pretty remarkable to see that uniform pattern. It is certainly, the law enforcement has taken great pride in what they consider to be the success of Miami, just as they did in the success of Los Angeles. And I think what time has shown is what they consider to be success, we have proven to be a failure. So, thank you.
want to start covering some of the practical issues of dealing with law enforcement, both here and in New York. There's a handout that we have that has three components to it. First is a two-page sheet on some important telephone numbers and a brief summary of your rights in New York. These are prepared by the National Lawyers Guild in New York, so it's based upon New York law. And there's a more detailed question and answer brochure, once again, geared toward New York. And then the final four pages is dealing with the police, which is something on our website, which is applicable here in California. First thing I want to talk about is FBI interviews. We are representing numerous people who are being contacted by the FBI in a wide variety of movements. Animal rights activists, Korean unification activists. I recently gave a presentation to the Korean Immigrant Workers Association. It was a bilingual presentation with an interpreter, and many of the people in the room have been approached by the FBI following visits to North Korea. And in fact, following my presentation, I had everybody raise their hand, I will not talk to the FBI. That got into the Korean press, and 2 weeks after my presentation, a woman was approached by the FBI, and she says, I'm not going to talk to you, talk to my lawyer. And the FBI said, who is your lawyer? She had read my name in the newspaper, and she said, Robert Myers is my lawyer. So the FBI is contacting numerous people, and they want you to talk. And my advice to activists is don't talk to the FBI without first consulting with a lawyer. And most lawyers will tell you not to talk to the FBI at all. And in fact, one of the reasons the FBI is contacting people is because it's often much easier to build a case against you for lying to an FBI agent than to build a case for a substantive crime. There's a very pernicious federal statute, 18 U.S.C. section 1001, which provides that it is a felony to provide materially incorrect information to any federal officer. So, for example, there's some activists up in Northern California who are being represented by a friend of mine. The FBI contacts them. The FBI comes and asks them about activities of an associate. And oftentimes, young people will just say, I don't know the people, or I don't know what they're up to or something. And the FBI says, well, you know the person, you've just provided materially false information, and they end up indicted for a federal crime. Now, you can't be indicted for providing materially false information to the FBI if you don't talk to the FBI. So the FBI is not your friend. The agents will come out and try to persuade you that you are a patriotic citizen and only criminals would refuse to talk to the FBI. They use a variety of tactics. And my sort of view is that the FBI is a terrorist organization. The Patriot Act says you should not provide material aid to a terrorist organization. So therefore, you should not talk to the FBI. Because the FBI is currently terrorizing American citizens who are engaged in free speech. And that is fundamentally wrong, and the FBI has a history of doing so. And so I think it's much safer to say, I'm not going to talk to you, I'm going to talk to a lawyer. And then you talk to a lawyer, and the lawyer can appropriately advise you of what to do. It is possible that they will give you a grand jury subpoena. And in fact, U.S. prosecutors are misusing grand jury subpoenas all the time. They are subpoenaing people to the grand jury when the grand jury isn't even in session. So the activist gets their grand jury subpoena, doesn't talk to a lawyer, serious mistake, shows up at the appointed time, and the U.S. attorney says, well, before we take you into the grand jury room, we want to do a pre-interview with you. And that's all they subpoenaed you for. There was no grand jury in session. It was a misuse of the grand jury process. And we recently had an activist in San Francisco subpoenaed to a federal grand jury investigating a 30-year-old crime under the guise of terrorism. Former members of the Black Liberation Movement, and they were subpoenaed, and a motion to quash the subpoena was filed, and the government withdrew the subpoena. So oftentimes, you know, when a grand jury subpoena is given, lawyers can make a motion to quash. That happened in Des Moines, Iowa, when students at Drake University had their records subpoenaed. National Lawyers Guild lawyers made a motion to quash the subpoena, and the government withdrew it. And so the government is abusing the grand jury. It's abusing its right to talk to people. And the rule of thumb is you shouldn't talk to the FBI when they come investigating activism without talking to a lawyer. You can only get yourself in trouble by doing so. And that's generally the rule in dealing with the police when you're at demonstrations. The police may want to stop and ask you questions. If you look at the materials, you know, if the police stop you on the street, ask if you're free to leave, and if you are, walk away from them. If the police ask to search your property, don't allow them to. I mean, I can walk up to anyone in this room and say, can I search that bag? And if you say yes, you surrendered whatever legal rights you have. The police can ask anything. You can say no. And that's very important, not to surrender your legal rights. If you have a backpack and they say, I want to search the backpack, and sir, I'm not consenting to the search of the backpack. Now, the police may do it anyway, and you may have a legal claim as a result, but never surrender your legal rights by talking to the police and providing information. It can only get you in trouble. You never want to provide false information to law enforcement. You don't want to get other people in trouble, and the best way to do that is to say nothing and to assert your legal rights, as we talk about in the program. A lot of people have heard about this new U.S. Supreme Court decision that came out of Nevada, where the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that a person had violated the law who had been lawfully detained by the police and under a Nevada statute had refused to identify himself, and he therefore was convicted of a violation of a Nevada statute. Now, there is no such statute in California currently. There could be one adopted in the future. The statute that California has on the books, which is, I think, Penal Code Section 647E, has been declared unconstitutional by the United States Supreme Court in Colander versus Lawson, and that case was not reversed in the Hybl versus Nevada Judicial District, I think, 6th Judicial District case that was decided this year. New York does not have a statute that requires identification upon detention. If you are lawfully arrested in New York, you will have to identify yourself at the police station and give your true name. Currently, under California law, under a court of appeal decision, if you're arrested for a misdemeanor, you can refuse to identify yourself. But if you're arrested for a felony, you cannot refuse to identify yourself. And that's the current state of California law. But generally speaking, if a police officer walks up to you and says, what's your name? You can say, none of your business. Now, one of the things that I think always important when we discuss people's legal rights is there are legal rights and then there's what happens on the street. Now, if I'm alone in an alley and a police officer comes up with me, I'm not going to be particularly sarcastic to the police officer because I'm by myself and the context is not right, a particularly good circumstance for me to assert my legal rights when I'm alone and this person has a gun. So you have to use common sense about when you will assert your legal rights and how you assert them. I think, you know, it's appropriate to try to politely assert your legal rights. I was at the anti-Bush demonstration in Santa Monica last week, and a police officer thought I was violating the law by standing on a grass area open to the general public, and the security guards had asked us to get off it, and I said, no, it's property open to the general public, it's not a crime to be here, and a police officer came up and said, you know, we have a letter on file from the owner, are you refusing to leave? And I said, what trespass statute are you enforcing? And he said, Penal Code Section 602, which has like 25 different trespass provisions, none of which apply. And I said, there is no provision of 602 that applies. I'm not committing a crime. This is property open to the general public. And he kept on saying, are you refusing to leave? And I said, no, I want to talk to your supervisor. Are you refusing to leave? No, I'm not refusing to leave. I want to talk to your supervisor. I am the supervisor. I said, no, you're not. You have a higher supervisor. And finally, he walked away. And I spoke to the city attorney afterwards, and she agreed with me. There was no criminal trespass. But I was doing that politely, and if he ultimately would have got his handcuffs out, I probably would have gotten off the grass, because it's not worth, you know, spending time in jail. But by asserting one's legal rights, one can often prevail. Terrorism task force raided his mother's house 2 years ago. Over and over again, the FBI is doing this with respect to people. I mean, including local law enforcement here. When there was an animal rights conference on May 17th, and some animal rights activists were driving in Orange County, you know, Costa Mesa police were following them and stopped them. I mean, the level of harassment by the government is extraordinary. In my, you know, 28 years as a lawyer, I've never seen so many people being approached by the government, and it is scary times we live in right now. People are being wiretapped. People are being followed, and people are being questioned. And if they don't want you to show up to the Republican National Convention, they'll serve you with a grand jury subpoena for your appearance during the time of the convention. It is an outright war on civil liberties going on in this country right now, and seeing it, you know, with lots and lots of people contacting us who are approached by the FBI, I can only tell you that I view the FBI as a terrorist organization, and activists should not assist them, because they're going after people for nothing. You know, these are called Joint Terrorism Task Force, and they're going after people for nothing. So for those of you going to New York, I'll just close, read the materials. If you have any questions, we can answer them at the end. Now I think it would be good for Carol to give an update of where the litigation is in New York.
And just, can I add one comment to something Bob said? If you're engaged with law enforcement officers now, I think you have to assume that they may have a voice-activated tape recorder in their shirt pocket. That was the case in the Hybel case in Nevada, so that the court could sort of go through the transcript of what had occurred there. And I think it's important, he may have had a videotape actually in his car, but it's important to begin from the assumption that there may be a record being made. So, you know, Bob did a great example of how to engage an officer respectfully and politely, but basically say no. And I think one of the other important things to say at the outset when the officer asks if you would identify yourself is, have I done something wrong, officer? Am I suspected of a crime? Am I being detained? If the officer's answer is no, you can walk away. So New York has been sort of a strange situation. As many of you may know, there have been a number of demonstrations over the last couple of years in New York, and probably the most significant one from a legal perspective was in February of 2003, when more than a million people took to the streets in New York, and the city refused to allow the march to go past the UN. And as a consequence, instead of having one street on the east side tied up. They had the entire east side of New York tied up because what was anticipated to be a march of several hundred thousand people wound up being well over a million people, as I understand it, who came out both to protest the police refusal to give the permit and to protest against the impending war. The city of New York has become even more aggressive since then. That what they've begun using are these pens. Now, those of us who demonstrate around here do not get penned in. We seem to be able to not have a problem. But in New York, the demonstrators are treated a lot more as thank you, I say as animals. And so they have these pens that they put up and these interlocking metal pens. They're, in February of 2003, no, once you were in the pen, you were not allowed out of the pen until the demonstration was over. And also, there were only limited ways to get into the pen. So if you happened to approach, you were there? Yeah, so if you happened to approach the demonstration from the wrong place, you could have to walk halfway around Manhattan to get to an entrance to the pen.
And the bathrooms, right. The porta potties they put on the outside of the pen. So right. If anybody had to use the facilities or get first aid, you were kicked out.
Right, and you know they had people in wheelchairs, people couldn't get out, yeah.
One of the biggest offenses was though they shut down the street to pedestrian and vehicular traffic, so you're in these pens.
Right, and there's nowhere to reach.
From the hotel that you're protesting, nobody can hear you except the police officers and the rest of you in the pen.
Exactly, exactly. So the New York Civil Liberties Union brought some litigation about this, and they just got a recent decision. And, you know, it's, well, it was certainly something of an improvement, I think, for anybody who was there, anybody who read about what happened. It's a little difficult to see it as a win, as a big win. Essentially, New York City can still pen you, and they will pen people for the demonstrations. They just have to allow you access in and out of the pens. They had, for February 2003, I believe it was, or they had searched everyone coming into the pens too, which creates this huge bottleneck. Mm-hmm. Now they can no longer search everyone. They have to have reasonable suspicion. Well, they'll have reasonable suspicion about everyone. They'll do what they say here. Yeah, we stopped them. They said, well, we had a report of chemical or biological agents being used here today, Carol, Bob. And, you know, at which point we go, oh, please. And why did you think this kid had it? Just because he was in black? And that usually is the answer. Don't think that because of this decision you won't be in pens. You will be in pens if you're going to New York, and you will be searched. It'll just be maybe every two out of three people instead of every three people. You'll be searched on the subways. They're thinking of doing that. The plan for New York is that all the demonstrators have been given an area which is running from 30th down to about 25th, 24th, 23rd, and on the west side between 8th, I think it is, over maybe to 6th or 5th, some of that. It's that kind of a neighborhood, that kind of an area. For those of you who know New York, you know that 30th Street means that you will not be seeing who's entering Madison Square Garden. The entrances, the 7th Street is going to be, will not be used for the delegates. 7th Street will be the entrance only for the subways. The trains from New Jersey have been shut down. You now will stop, the railroad will stop in Newark, and you'll have to take the path from Newark to Lower Manhattan and then come up. That tells me, as somebody, as I told you, was from New Jersey, that tells me that they're closing the tunnel, that you probably won't be able to get into the city through the Lincoln Tunnel, and you won't. You may or may not be able to get in through the Holland Tunnel, but I think not, because now the whole hype is, it's, you know, truck bombs. So Boston did that. Boston closed every access road into the city, every tunnel, every bridge, for the time of the demonstration. And so what you got were delegates inside the Fleet Center and a few demonstrators in the replica of, a hometown replica of Gitmo, where people did street theater and, you know, nothing much happened. There weren't a lot of demonstrators in Boston. I don't think the situation would be quite that in New York. There was a plan for a major, other than that area, that's where the protests are going to be allowed. There are other marches that are going to take place in the city. The major issue, of course, has been about around the UFPJ march and the 250,000 people and whether that rally would be allowed to occur on the Great Lawn of Central Park. As of right now, it is still under the West Side Highway, which I envision as being decorated with barbed wire and other accessories of the government as it was in Boston. You know, Boston, you looked at the pictures and everybody described Boston as looking like a concentration camp or Guantanamo, and everybody said, oh no, uh-uh. And even the judge, when he finally saw the picture, said, oh my God, because it was barbed wire all around. I mean, it didn't even look that bad in L.A., which was the first major fence city, because we were open on three sides, at least. At least for us, they fenced in Staples Center rather than fence in us. And I always think it looks better if the delegates are behind barbed wire. But we didn't have barbed wire. But by Boston, they had barbed wire, and I think you'll see more of that in New York. Police have not said at all what they're going to do to that West Side Highway area. And I think it's going to be a situation when people show up one night, nothing's going to be there. The next day when they get there, as were the barricades in Los Angeles, they were not there the night of the Abu Jamal. That's not the right name. Mumia Abu Jamal, yeah. Okay, they were not there the night of the, you know, if they get older, it gets harder to keep things straight. They were not there the night before the demonstration started. The night that they shot everybody, there were these barricades that blocked everybody's exit getting out. So I think you can see something like that. UFPJ had threatened to sue, then agreed to the West Side Highway site, and has now brought a lawsuit that got filed today in state court in New York, seeking to get the Great Lawn of Central Park. And the city has taken the position that the Great Lawn will no longer hold 250,000 people.
It's
the grass. Yeah, it's the grass. Well, it's grass, yeah. Of course, the grass will hold people. My view is the grass will hold people if they're there for a Philharmonic concert or a Dave Matthews Band concert. And that's because it is scientifically proven that grass dies faster if people are shouting "No more war" than if they're listening to Bach. I think that really has been proven now. But so that's the issue. And the real issue, though, is, you know, they've been really blatant. And Bloomberg says there will not be a demonstration in Central Park. He doesn't care. Come hell or high water, there will be no demonstration in his park. And Bloomberg is part of the Central Park Conservancy. And the position is that the Central Park Conservancy spent a lot of money to restore the park, and they get to make the decisions now about what it gets used for. So these private people, the large corporations, and surprisingly, or coincidentally, or amazingly, or, you know, anyone, the primary user of the park, in addition to the Philharmonic, has been AOL, which did the Dave Matthews concert, which did the opening party, which did all of these things. They get to put up all the AOL signs, and AOL apparently has bought permanent place on the Great Lawn of Central Park. But there's a second lawsuit, or first lawsuit, that was filed. I and a colleague filed a lawsuit in last Friday seeking the Great Lawn of Central Park for a demonstration on August 28th, the day before, for the National Council of Arab Americans, I think it's the name of the client, and Answer Coalition, which is working with them and a number of other groups. The permit being sought by our clients is for 75,000 people, 10,000 people less than were there for the Philharmonic concert, 5,000 people less than were there for the Dave Matthews concert, and on the Great Lawn, and in no way interferes or is contradictory to the way that the Great Lawn has been used even since the renovation. So we have a hearing Friday afternoon in our case. The state court judge apparently is waiting to see what the federal court judge does. The judges are all sort of perplexed about what to do. In our case, our client filed their permit application in January, was told in January that the park would not decide who was going to get a permit for the Great Lawn until they saw what needs were there for the park during the RNC. And subsequently, our client's permit was denied because the park said they do not permit the Great Lawn to be used for events of this nature. We still haven't figured out what that is. And as you know, UFPJ's permit was denied because they don't do events of that size any longer. So, you know, the Paul Simon concert was 250,000 people. Somebody else was 500,000 people. There were anti-war marches that used to be there. There was a papal mass for over 100,000 people. But they no longer allow it to be used for that anymore because of the grass and the landscaping. Our client fits within all the parameters. So we're waiting to see what happens with that. At the moment, there's no other litigation anticipated. We had another potential challenge to the permitting process for parades, but the police have now announced that they are giving a permit to another client of ours as requested and for a prime spot on a prime day. So they backed off the position that no one would be allowed in another location. The park is going to be the fight, and Mayor Bloomberg has made it his personal stand. I hope it's like, you know, I hope it, I hope he goes down in flames over that. That's just a figure of speech. Just really need to explain these things these days, but, you know, Mayor Bloomberg doesn't own the park, and neither do his friends. It is sort of extraordinary. I mean, Central Park is the heart of the city. It really is. It is the heart of the city. People want to use it for something that is at the heart of a democracy, at the quadrennial selection of a presidential candidate, somebody who's going to lead this country. What are they afraid of? So that's the update on the litigation in New York. Bob won't go, but I'm going to New York as of next week and be working with various groups, the Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and on litigation as it becomes necessary. And maybe if Bob changes his mind, we can get him there too. But it's, you know, it's going to be an interesting time because the city has made public statements. Commissioner Kelly has announced several weeks ago now, almost 2 months ago now, that they expected 1,000 arrests a day. And the demonstrators are looking at each other and saying, who? You know, where are they getting 1,000 arrests a day? No one is going there intending that there be that. But they are so primed. Police are so primed to shut down anything. And New York has some of the worst laws I've seen about demonstrating in public places. So I think people have to be prepared. And as Bob said, they have a lot more officers. They have more than 40,000 police officers. They have, you know, some 5.5 times what we have in Los Angeles, and they will have their National Guard out, and they will have other people. So you're probably going to see, you know, more police officers in New York, particularly around Madison Square Garden. I think what's going to happen is what basically happened in Boston. A lot of people are just leaving the city, and they're not going to be around. And I think that sets up an interesting issue, because I think at a certain point, the excesses of displays of force come back to be a negative economic force, when the whole notion of having the FTA in Miami or having the convention in New York is to bring this, promote the city. And what they promote instead is the image, as they did in LA, of a police state. And who wants to come to a police state, you know, to visit? So that's pretty much an update on New York, and I guess we'll take other questions you may have.
Thank you.